Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Welcome to Nurses and Hypochondriacs. I am your host, Ercilia Pompilio. And again, we have a really hot topic today, and very, very hot. It's garnered a lot of media attention lately, so our topic today is valley fever. And I'm really excited to bring on our first guest, Julie Solis. She is a valley fever advocate. She is a community activist. She's a mom, wife, and lover of life. Our second guest today is Abner Vilches, and he's a family nurse practitioner. He's going to be our nurse expert today. So welcome, both of you.
Welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us in the show.
Great. I'm so excited, as always. Cool. So let's start with your story first, Julie. Tell us how you got involved with valley fever.
Well, so I lived in Bakersfield, Kern County for about over a dozen years, and it was wonderful. We moved here, good affordable prices on homes, and we were living life wonderfully until around December 2007, my husband started getting sick. We didn't know what was wrong with him, and so we started going to the doctors, and he was being misdiagnosed. They were saying he had the flu, then it was bronchitis, then it was pneumonia, and then it was stress, and then it was he was overweight, and then we started looking for cancer, and we tested him for AIDS. We were just like hunting to find out this mysterious illness. Over 6 months into his illness, I walked in the room one day and I thought he was dead. He was so ill. And so finally that trip to the emergency room, unlike the other dozens of trips, they did a spinal tap on him and they said that he had meningitis and that my husband was dying. I wasn't really sure, you know, everything kind of happened so quickly. But they said that he either had West Nile or coccidioidal mucosis, aka valley fever. They were not sure which one he had, but they knew it was in his brain. They knew he had meningitis and they knew he was dying. And so it's been 9 years of struggling to keep my husband alive. And we've recently been in an epidemic this past year, and nothing's really been done as far as, you know, conversations and bringing it out to the public and awareness. And so a little over a year ago, I decided to get involved and push along the topic and see where it could lead. And I'm really happy that it seems to be trending now. And a lot of people are finally giving valley fever the respect for this incurable disease that it deserves.
That's excellent. And yes, it's been trending a lot. I mean, valley fever, I got the epidemiology reports. I was listening to NPR in my car actually last Wednesday. And there's an increase in 30% from last year, from 2016 to 2017. Also from 2011, from the research I've pulled, there's been an 800% increase. That's crazy.
Absolutely. I mean, where else? Last winter, the newspaper report, it came out a press release, and it said that from September 20th through December 31st, there would be over 2,000 people infected, 28 people a day. Where else, in what capacity, do 28 people a day be diagnosed and nobody bats an eye? Nobody made a big deal of it. That press release was really what got me going, because I just found it so heart-drenching, especially in my circumstance where we'd lost everything over these years trying to keep my husband alive. And I knew that we were strong enough for it because we had been handling it, but I thought about my neighbors and my community and why should they have to lose everything like we did? And so, you know, it's just, it really needs attention. Valley fever truly does.
So let's go back to your story. Your husband starts getting sick. Do you remember what symptoms he had?
So yeah, so right at the beginning of Christmas break, I was working as a substitute teacher at the time. And so me and the kids were happy to be off, you know, for Christmas vacation. And we noticed that he was just really tired. We thought he was getting the flu. Although he had already got the flu shot, we thought that, you know, there's different strains. We didn't really think that much of it. Overall, my husband was really healthy, so we didn't get concerned right away. Towards the end of our Christmas vacation, I started noticing, I'm like, it's been a couple weeks and you're feeling even worse. So I went ahead and took him to the doctor, and they said that he had the flu, even though he had the flu shot. They gave him some medicine. They said, just take it easy. Your lungs, you know, are sounding really horrible, and we don't want you to get bronchitis. Well, then he ended up with bronchitis. Then they gave us medication. Then it turned to pneumonia. Then they gave us medication. Finally, when the pneumonia went away, he started having headaches. So about the first month, we kind of went through the stages of coughing, bronchitis, pneumonia, and then the coughing went away, but then headaches immediately followed.
So where do they think that your husband got sick? Like, we were talking about before your husband's profession.
Yes. So my husband is a truss designer, T-R-U-S-S. So he does kind of the roof designs on our homes, our ceilings and things. So the majority of his job was working in an office on a computer, but the products that he created were for brand new construction. And so, you know, a couple, two, three times a week, my husband was out in new construction job sites remeasuring. And so he was out in new, you know, newly turned dirt all the time. But yet at the same time, we had purchased a new construction home less than a year before he got sick. And they were building an elementary school across the street from us. Now, I had no idea of Valley Fever. I was not ever told about Valley Fever. And so we used to go with our quads, and we used to go play in the dirt on the weekend, you know, when they did the groundbreaking and they would dig little holes and make those little hills. We would put our helmets on and we would go, you know, we put our helmet on for that risk of brain injury, but nobody told us the inhalation. You know, nobody ever told us about the Valley Fever. We were not informed. And so foolishly, we went and played in the dirt all the time. And so we're not certain where he got the Valley Fever from. It could have been from work at a new construction site. At the same time, it could have also been from that new construction across the street from our home.
Yeah. And like I mentioned before, with the cases, I have like the current cases with the California Department of Public Health. From January 1st to October 31st, there were 5,121 provisional cases of Valley Fever, an increase of 1,294 over the 3,827 cases reported in 2016. That's insane. So I'm going to go into what Valley Fever is, and you can chime in because I know you're so educated on Valley Fever. You're an expert. And, you know, I started doing my research and it was fascinating to me. So Valley Fever is known as coccidioidomycosis, correct? Yes. And it's caused by a spore, yes, of a fungus that grows in soil in parts of California, Arizona, and other areas of the Southwest United States. People get infected by breathing in the spores present in dirt that gets into the air when it's windy or when the soil is disturbed, such as digging during construction. So most people who get Valley Fever fully recover and usually are protected from getting the disease again. But Valley Fever can infect the brain, joints, bones, skin, and other organs, and it can be fatal. And it's also seen an increase in interesting areas like San Luis Obispo, Merced, Fresno, Kern, Madera, and Tulare have seen huge increases. And most people who contract Valley Fever don't have symptoms, But those who do might experience fever, cough, chest pain, headache, and weight loss. The disease often is misdiagnosed because it resembles so many other illnesses. And experts say health officials recommend that if people have had a cough, fever, or painful breathing for more than 2 weeks, they should ask their doctor about Valley fever. And that was, I got that article from November 14, 2017, LA Times. So it's very current information there. So let's go ahead and talk about coccidiomycosis a little bit. I sent you that picture of that guy, the Alejandro Posadas, who discovered the cocci. So the cocci first was discovered in 1892 by a physician named Alejandro Posadas. And he kind of looks like Salvador Dali with his twirled up mustache. So he is very much a character. And in the late 1800s, medicine was kind of like theater. Surgeons would perform and they would have these costumes in their hair and their make. It just was very, very interesting what was coming out. And we've seen even from the podcasts we've done, there's even been operas created from illnesses and stuff, which is all very fascinating to me. And so this Alejandro Posadas guy, the way he figured out and studied coccidiomycosis was from a skin infection off of this one guy. And they still have the head preserved of the original patient that was diagnosed and came to be. And that's like way over 100 years old. And I guess it's somewhere in Argentina, which is very fascinating to me. So tell us a little bit about, what led you on to being an advocate? You said you thought nothing was being done. There wasn't any more really attention put to this since it is affecting so many people, and it can also arise. Like I have some stats here too from the Northridge earthquake. There were 203 cases in 1994 of Valley fever. So it's not really in one location. You know, because they're saying, oh, it's only Bakersfield. It doesn't exist anywhere else. I mean, I even have an article here that says one of the farm workers got Valley fever. And I think he was living in Arizona or something. So he came down to Torrance Memorial Hospital and he had the same symptoms. And they didn't test him. They kept misdiagnosing him and mistesting him until finally someone told him about Valley fever and he got tested and they're like, oh yeah, well, we don't see this down here. You know, and I think that this is very common in healthcare now. It's just because they don't see something, they think it doesn't exist in that area and it's only endemic in one area. But with Valley fever, because of the winds and because it's the spore, I mean, it can travel. And they've been blaming the increase of Valley fever on, of course, global warming. So
absolutely. What I find fascinating as an advocate, I hear stories all day long. I meet new people and these stories are all so different, yet they all end up similar with being diagnosed with Valley fever. A couple things that I really took notice to is one, misdiagnosis. It is rare that I've met someone who said, yes, I went to the doctor and right away I got a test and ruled out Valley fever. Here locally where we live in an endemic area, people are having to request tests and it's common for doctors to not do the testing. People are needing to request the test for Valley fever. The second thing that I really notice is how the spores travel. You know, I've met people out of state who never came to an endemic area that got sick when we shipped cocci to them. I have a friend who lives in Pennsylvania. She ordered hay for her horse. Her horse died and she ended up in the hospital, turned out to be Valley fever. I've met another lady that lives in the Ohio area. She last year for the Cyber Monday, she ordered shoes online from my local distribution center. She ended up in the ICU with cocci. She's still sick today. It has disseminated throughout her body, so it will be a lifelong illness for her. I've met people, all over. I met a young man 18 years old, same age as my son. I met his grandma when he graduated from high school. He came out to Las Vegas to visit his father, ended up with Coxy, went back home to Florida, and he now has it in his brain, living like my husband. It will also be a lifelong illness. And so I've met, you know, it's story after story of we ship Coxy around the United States and also around the world. The spores are microscopic. We cannot see them, and it only takes one spore to get sick. 40% of the people who breathe in the spore will get some kind of reaction. 60% will become immune. But at the same time, we have that where Coxy is also known to lay dormant in your body. So I met a lady who lived in Kern County over 30 years ago, but was recently diagnosed with Valley fever. When she lived here, she was healthy. Recently, she was diagnosed with diabetes. And then that's when Coxy also, if it's dormant in you, when your immune system is suppressed, it can activate and then you can begin to get sick.
That's a great, excellent point that you bring up, which I will segue into, and we'll look at, like, what are the populations that are most affected by Coxy? And I have an article here that was published in Emerging Infectious Disease in October 22nd, 2016. And it says that the populations, of course, it's in Arizona and California, the most endemic areas, but the coccidiomycosis-associated deaths were shown to increase among African Americans, but decrease among Native Americans and Hispanics. However, if Native Americans had diabetes, so it co-varied with coccidiomycosis-associated death, so they had higher predisposition of death. And also the Filipino population, it shows that there is an increase in that. And we'll segue, because I did bring up, and I did talk to you about, this was when Charles Manson was still alive, that he was admitted for a mysterious illness, and he was in the prisons in Bakersfield. And now we can segue to Abner and kind of talk about your experience with coccidiomycosis.
It is true. I've been hearing exactly, it is true what you guys said about coccidiomycosis. I had my chance to come across coccidiomycosis when I moved to Bakersfield, actually in 2007, right about the time your husband came down. And I was working at a clinic out in East Bakersfield, and I was seeing patients. But one of the typical hallmark of the disease is a rash, usually in the legs. It's a red rash in the legs. Or they have no rash and they come out with flu-like symptoms and high fevers, usually. The rash is kind of raised and is red and almost looks like a wheel. I don't know if you like they've been bitten by bugs. And they actually haven't. And are usually people that aren't outdoors. And in San Gabriel Valley is very endemic. And the winds, it usually happens when the winds, I don't know if you've been to Bakersfield, but sometimes there are, one morning I got out and it was like Armageddon. It was all dusty and orange looking, and like in the afternoons even, I come out of the clinic and you're like, what is going on? It is the winds that come in with a fog. And it stirs out the spores into the air. And I've seen, I'm like, what is this? I was trained at in LA, at UCLA, but we spoke about it, but not much into it until I got to Bakersfield. And yeah, you draw blood and do the titers, but it will take you about a week or two weeks to get the results back. In the meantime, what I did as a nurse practitioner, we practice, right? We see what we are seeing clinically right in front of it. And so I, as long as they didn't have any chronic conditions, kidney infection or any prior illness, I would start on fluconazole. and they were responded right away. I mean, it was like miraculously. It happened, and they would turn around within 24 hours. You see the results. And I did work at Kern Valley State Prison, and all of the Bakersfield area is surrounded by state prisons, and they're built on the spores. They're built on the actual soil that is contaminated. And it's also not only that, but it's also the salad bowl of LA. That's what we agriculture. And you did say something about African Americans. Yes, I came across sad pictures in Kern Valley State Prison, where I saw African Americans mostly on wheelchairs at the age only of 40. And I was, it's not possible. And the saddest thing is they're not dying from anything else but valley fever. As soon as they get there and they end up on a wheelchair and it becomes disseminated, at that point, it's untreatable. It's gone. You have to see organ failure, it's palliative care, and eventually they will surrender to their fight with valley fever. And also Hispanics, they work in agriculture. They will come in usually on a Friday afternoons, right before closing time in the clinic. And you say, well, we had this fever, we don't know what it's like, he's not feeling well, there's fatigue. And it's not necessarily the flu season, although your husband already had the flu vaccine. Yeah, I've seen that happen. I've seen the scenario. And it takes actually someone that has been involved in it and isn't pay attention to the cases are coming through in Bakersfield, especially. And it is a dark secret. We don't talk about it much. It involves, economics. To remove all those prisons from there, we need the land. Actually, the soil is very good for multiple vegetables, and we also have grapes. It's the number one production of pistachio in the world, and we have oranges, you name it. So the economic factor is very great, but we don't talk about it.
Well, it's a $6 million. It's a $6 million industry out there.
Yes.
For agriculture alone, and it's interesting that it's affecting the farm workers. Another thing that was interesting to me, because it affects Filipinos in such a negative way. I mean, who are the nurses? There's like a huge population of Filipino nurses. So I mean, it's funny to me that nobody's really paying that much attention.
In Delano, which is the city right next to us, it's our neighboring city, they have the highest condensed population per capita of Filipinos in California, in a small city named Delano. And so yet, although they, are sitting sitting ducks at risk, nobody's educating. Our doctors are not being educated. What we are known for here in Kern County are for our traveling doctors. Most of the doctors in our emergency rooms are traveling through. They may be on assignment for 2 weeks or 2 months, and then they're off. So them coming into this endemic area and not understanding it is really another reason why misdiagnosis is so common. An example of that is a friend of mine. He's a valley fever survivor. Shane is his name, and he actually has cocci in his brain. And he was with some family, and he started noticing black and white spots. through his eyes. He got really scared. They were around the street from an emergency room, and it's a local emergency room here in Bakersfield. So his family brought him to the emergency room, and the physician that came into the room had not heard of Valley Fever when he told him that he had Coxsackie meningitis. The emergency room physician had to leave, and he came back with another doctor a while later. So that's really scary, because had Shay not know he had Valley Fever, what would that doctor that had never heard of Valley Fever say? I mean, I think that there's no excuse for having physicians working in our emergency rooms in an endemic area and not knowing the signs and treatments for Valley Fever. That should be something that, as part of our community, we need. We need physicians who are educated to be at the front line in our emergency rooms.
And I completely agree with you on that. And we'll hear from – go ahead. Did you want to add something, Abner?
Yeah, she does have a reason. One of the reasons I came in 2007 is because that is the highest for a loan reimbursement through the National Health Service Corps, the federally funded clinics and hospitals where you need your loans repaid. So those are the high scores up in the 18 score, 20 is the maximum, 22. And so people tend to go there, doctors, nurse practitioners, dentists, to the area. But that we're just going there for like a 2-year service and get it out. That's it. Most people just go in there, get the loans repaid, and then you're going back where you came from. You go back to your other state or big cities like, you know, like LA, where it's a lot more glamour than Fresno or Bakersfield or Delano. There is not really nothing to do there as far as cultural wise, but unless you look for it and you find it, Bakersfield is amazing. So yeah, it's true. We're not trained. We come here, and I had the fortunate position to be in a clinic out in East Bakersfield. I don't know if you know East Bakersfield, but it is really there is a big need for medical help, and it was us, the nurse practitioners, out there working, and they throw us in to see the patients, and you have to be very savvy and pay attention to detail, and you have to put two and two together. Aha! This is Valley Fever.
And I think you're bringing a good point. I'm going to interject real quick there. People have to be very intuitive, and they have to have know what the symptoms are. They have to have seen it. But with these ICD-9 codes, is there an ICD-9 code for Valley Fever?
Now it's ICD-10. We have moved to the ICD-10.
Oh, yeah, ICD-10. Right.
Yeah, there is codes for Valley Fever. Absolutely. Multiple codes as to where the location, how far it is, disseminated, complications, not complications. This is the initial encounter. Is it a subsequent encounter? So, yeah, it's rather complex, but you have to know the face of it. You have to be familiar with it. And you have to know the codes. That's another thing. And you only have 5 minutes to do all that. That's the bottom line, economics.
So let's talk quickly about some of the serology tests. Like, say a patient comes to you, Abner, and the symptoms are cough, fever, and the rash. What is the first test you would do?
I would do a titer of the coccidiomycosis right away.
Right. So is it the IgM serology, the complement fixation antibody titer?
Yes, you do the titers. Sometimes the IgM, this is something very specific. I don't know if you're going to talk about the technicalities of it, but all you need to know is that sometimes it could be a false positive. It depends on the condition of the patient. Have the patient develop antibodies? Is it really showing? And you're not treating really the number. You're treating the patient. Oftentimes, physicians, well, it looks like it. It mimics like it. The rash is there. All the conditions are there. You have to look at the factors. It was exposed. It was agriculture, construction worker. It's in the prison because the dust is blowing all the time. is always outside. On her case, you know, it's unfortunate. Your husband was in, you know, working in an office, but only came out to the work field once or twice a month. But yeah, you have to look at all that and then go, okay, it looks like that. Let's do a trial with fluconazole. That is the drug of choice, and see how it goes. And if there is no contraindications as to like liver function or chronic conditions, they bounce back, and then you got the diagnosis right there.
So it's great that you segued into treatments. We'll talk a little bit about treatments. So you have the azoles, which are your antifungals for treatment, right, Abner? You got your fluconazole, your itraconazole, your voriconazole, and the posaconazole. So extreme cases, you get Paulines, the amphotericin, right, fungizone. And it could cause renal dysfunction in something called shake and bake, where you're constantly shaking from the side effects of the medication.
Yeah, when you get to the amphotericin, you're going IV, you're going already hospital. You're speaking of dissemination. The walk-in clinic that I work, I don't get that far. Borinox is another one, but that's mostly for histoplasmosis, which I had personally, the histoplasmosis. I know I've had it. I got it in Tennessee. I didn't know what it was.
One of our podcast guests just got histoplasmosis as well.
Yes, it's another
story. And she's from that area, not Tennessee, but one of the states close to Tennessee.
Yeah, so that's another spore that is in the air, but going back to valley fever, coccidiomycosis, you try usually the fluconazole, and then you get up to 200, and then 400 is the doses that you get. You get there, you don't want to go further up, but you'll see right away a response. So, and that is a walk-in clinic. Once you get to other amphotericin B or anything like that, you try to refer the patient to infectious disease. Proper management. That's what I do as a nurse practitioner. I do the trial, see how they respond, so long as they're on walking basis. If they're in such acute case that they are not even able to walk, temperatures of 103, confusion, then you send them to the ER. That's the end of it. And in the ER, they may or may not get the proper treatment, and I have to see them again. I mean, I see them again on a Monday. I'm like, what happened to you? I sent you on the ER. They said, well, they had a cold. They gave me Tylenol.
That is so ER. I've had similar cases just happen to me where they diagnose somebody with a rash. And I'm like, that is not a rash. So they're coming to me. Okay, they diagnose them on a Sunday. They come to me on a Monday. And I'm like, that's not a rash. You know, that's Henoch-Schlon and purpura, you know, and it's freaking me out. And they have bruising on bilateral legs. And I'm like, oh my God, it could be meningitis. It could be leukemia. It could be polycythemia. And in the ER, I just send them home with rash. And I had to send them to Loma Linda, you know, and I didn't want to freak out the mom. The kid was sick. He looked sick and he was put on steroids. And so Loma Linda confirmed it. And I saw the kid the week later. And my medical assistant was like, guess what? You won the prize. You guessed right. I'm like, oh, cool. Henoch-Schlon and purpura. Yeah, it's a pediatric illness. I've seen it a million times. And the ER probably has never seen it, you know, whoever took care of him. So, yeah.
They haven't usually, and I see them on Mondays with a fever still, Tylenol, calamine lotion, or hydrocortisone cream for their insect bites.
Exactly, and it's something so much more serious.
But yes.
Yeah. Cool. So let's go into more of the politics of valley fever and what's been going on the political range. Julie, can you go ahead and tell us about what you've been doing and tell us about the bill that just got knocked down by Governor Brown. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that was really disappointing. I'm over it now. I'm not going to cry again. But Assembly Bill 1279 was introduced by Assemblyman Rudy Salas from right here in Bakersfield. He's a really great, advocate of Valley Fever. And so I was really pleased when I spoke with him. Originally, when I started this venture, all I wanted was money to do the trial, because there's a possible cure at the University in Arizona. And so I was very eager to just say, we need that. But speaking with Assemblyman Rudy Salas, we came to the realization that what's really important here is to get an accurate number. There are no accurate numbers for Valley Fever. If you were to go down to the Kern County Department of Public Health and you were to say, how many women ages 18 to 24 have gonorrhea, they will tell you exactly how many. If you go in and you ask them how many women 18 to 24 were diagnosed with Valley Fever, they would give you an approximation number. So there are no guidelines. Although Valley Fever is reported in 37 counties in California, everybody kind of has their own procedure. So at the end, when you talk to the state, CDC, and local health departments, everybody is kind of doing their own thing. So Assembly Bill 1279 was supposed to give us a unifying procedural way to be able to start reporting. That way we would have accurate numbers and accounting of this illness. It went through the assembly and there were zero opposition. Republicans and Democrats alike agree that Valley Fever awareness is necessary. Reporting guidelines are necessary. It went through the Appropriations Committee, no opposition. It went through the Senate, no opposition. Not one elected official has ever opposed it. Everybody's on board with it. When the bill reached the governor's desk, the California Department of Public Health and the Department of Finance both spoke with the governor, and they felt like it should be a budget item and that it really didn't need a bill and that it really didn't need all that. And so Governor Jerry Brown, he vetoed the bill.
That is so scary to me. And one of my biggest quips and the reason why I'm doing this podcast is because people in politics don't get health care. Hello? They don't get health care. Don't mess with it. You know, have 21 years plus experience in the healthcare field, and I'm not the biggest expert. You know, I do my research. I talk to people. I have this podcast. I get other experts and stuff. You know, but these people in politics, they don't get what's going on. I mean, the sole fact for me, and I've told other Filipino nurses, I go, did you realize that coccidioidomycosis affects Filipinos and it can cause death? Like, they have a very slim chance of getting it out. That's all our nurses. Thank you, people on the front lines. It's going to affect people on the front lines. You know, that alone is huge, you know, and also that it is affecting people in agriculture who are taking care of our food, and also people in the prison systems, you know, and not to mention people who are working in the prison systems. I mean, it's, you cannot contract it from person to person. It is contractable only from the spores. However, it's huge, you know, and it's like, people in politics, stop, get consultants out there, you know, get, people in healthcare coming on board and showing you, go to the hospitals, talk to patients like we're doing on this show, with people who have had this disease process. Learn. They don't care. It's all money and cents, and it sucks. You know, healthcare is not a business. I'm so sick and tired of it.
Yes. You know, my husband, it's been 9 years of struggling to keep my husband alive. And about 99% of the struggle is the health insurance. I'm an advocate for health for all in California. You know, we have that bill, SB 562, health for all. And I'm totally for that. Before my husband got sick, we owned properties. We had, you know, things, RVs and boats. You know, we had fun things. We had our ATV we'd go play in the dirt with. My kids each had a savings. All three of our children had $10,000 CDs at Bank of America. So my husband and I, we were living what I call the American dream. Since then, it's turned into the American nightmare from the insurance. You know, my husband's on Bora Cazoli, which cost over $16,000 a month. So there was a point about a year and a half ago where the insurance company was really pressuring his doctor, his infectious disease doctor, to try another medication that was not as costly. The medication would not work. It was not working. My husband ended up in the hospital, and it was an over $40,000 bill for a trial because the insurance would not approve his medicine. So the doctor had to basically just put my husband in the hospital so that he can get the IV medication that the insurance company was denying the pill form. And so through these years, we have battled with insurance companies, and just to keep my husband alive, we call it the red tape. I always wondered when people said red tape, I think I know what they're talking about. And I think that's what it is. That red tape of insurance companies saying, that's going to be an expensive procedure. Let's try this. About 5 years ago, my husband had to do the dreaded amniotericin injections. That was torturous. Never in my life, besides the night that he was dying and they thought that he was going to die, never have I seen such horrific. I mean, my husband, they had to tie him down with bed ties because his body was shaking so profusely. He didn't even have normal skin tone colors during the treatment. He was so ill. When my mom did chemo, her chemo was not even comparable to those amniotericin injections. He did those 3 days a week for 2 months, and it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. Horrible torture is what it was.
Well, I can imagine. Have you seen patients getting the amphotericin, Abner?
Yeah, but at that point, you are just playing with fire, really, to be honest. Because you don't know if you're going to die from the actual disease or they're going to die from the drug and how effect it's going to cause in the kidneys and the liver. So you're playing with fire at that point. And and this is off kind of the politics. This morning I was watching. I don't know if you guys know what Robert Reich is. He was the former Secretary of Labor during Clinton administration. He is also a professor at UC Berkeley. He's an activist. And if you can watch on Netflix, Saving Capitalism, and it will speak about what we're doing, what's happening to our country, and about healthcare overall. What is going on? And I see all your in the background says resist and being an activist. Try to watch it. And it's on Netflix called Saving Capitalism by Robert Reich. Okay. I think it would apply to it, into the issue of economics and what is happening to our country by big corporations.
Okay, go ahead. Finish.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Now, I was going to ask you to tell that story you told me about one of the prisoners that was in the hole when you were working in the prison system, and how he was really sick and you needed to admit him to the hospital.
Yes, it was one afternoon, and it was on a Friday. It was, we're feeling rushed. We got to go. We got to, when you work in the prison, you go through a lot of security to get in and to get out. Most of us, and the physicians and nurse practitioners, we are rushed to go through the process. And there was a young kid that just was sentenced to 40 to life. Young, white, male, healthy, rather. And he had been several times to see for a medical visit, and I happened to, they sent me that day, they will, as a nurse practitioner, they sent me to different locations. I'll drive my little golf cart around the prison with all my boxes and boxes of files, the medical files, and I will go, okay, Abner, you're going to A or B or C. You know, they're divided.
The visual of you doing that is like.
No problem, doctor, I'm going to the yard. Well, you're going to the hall, Abner. That was a common saying in the morning. Going to the hall. It's, nobody wants to go there.
So but what is the hall? Explain what the hall is quickly for people who don't know.
It's a prison within a prison within a prison. Well, that's the bottom line. When you are misbehaving, when you are, or sometimes when they have defected, they no longer want to be part of the gang and they are actually protected. They need to be, that's where they go. And they don't get, it's completely enclosed. It's only a vent system, and they get 1 hour, 24 hours for exercise outside. It is dehumanizing, but that's what happens. And you go there, and you see, you do the medical visits. So I arrived there with my golf cart and my boxes of files, and this kid is like, he looked normal, but he was running temperatures of 102. And I said, you've been here often. I looked through the file and I went in there. He's in his shock, you know, in chains and shackles and handcuffs. And I went and I examined and I lifted his pants. And sure enough, he had the rash, the typical rash right there. I said, has anyone seen you or examined you like that? Yeah, but I had a cold. That's what they told me. And the weeks have gone by. I called that day. I said, he is going to Bakersfield right now. Get him out of here. That's the last I heard. You don't get to follow, unfortunately, because they move you around. And I think he probably got better. I started the medication and I said, you're going to Bakersfield. You're going to go to a hospital. You are not well. Although he had 40 years ahead of him in prison where they're exposed to it. But you have to know, you have to be familiar with the disease. You have to see the hallmark and you have to examine, put your hands on the patients, touch them. Feel, see what's going on.
Those are excellent points that you bring up, Abner. So, Julie, just to wrap everything up, I know you're doing phone banks as well to put the word out. I know you're doing the gardening in Bakersfield, the community gardens. Talk briefly about those. And then to wrap up, what can we do? What is the takeaway? And what can anybody listening to this podcast do to get more advocacy with Valley Fever and more awareness about the effects of Valley Fever?
Okay, absolutely. Thank you. Real quick, I wanted to kind of touch on what Abner was just speaking about, the prisons. As a Valley Fever advocate, I'm constantly in contact with loved ones of people who are in prison. When people are sentenced to prison for a crime, they go to prison, you do your time, and you are released. Your debt to society is done. Although I've met tons of people, for example, Pete, he was sent to prison for 2 years. He is now living with Coxsackie meningitis for the rest of his life. And so our prison system is in a unique situation with Valley Fever. And I really, really feel strongly that something more needs to be done. We are not sentencing people to this torturous disease. So that's really unfortunate. Our prison system and the way that most of our prisons in California are located in endemic areas. So I just kind of wanted to touch on that because it's really unfortunate.
Those are great points that you're bringing up. Excellent. Mom,
loved ones, fathers and husbands and it's really hard to know that there are people laying in beds in prisons throughout this valley that are being misdiagnosed and that are dying and that are going to live with a lifelong illness. So that's real unfortunate. On the outside of those prison walls, throughout the whole Central Valley, being a Valley Fever advocate takes me out to the streets. I'm conversating with people and I'm learning from people. And like I said earlier, I hear so many stories and each one is unique. And at the bottom line, they all end up with a misdiagnosis. And so what I always tell people is if you're sick, request the test and rule out Valley fever. Even if you think you may not have it, if you're sick and you don't have to have a fever, you don't have to have the rash, you can have one symptom. After my husband was diagnosed about 3 months later, I noticed that my daughter, who was second grade at the time, she was really exhausted. And so one day I told her, I said, Marisa, why don't you go play? You know, why aren't you outside? And she said she was so tired and that her body just felt like hurting. It was so tired. So I took her to a pediatrician who I had been with for about 9 years. And I asked for a Valley fever test. The pediatrician told me that she thought I was over-exaggerating and that she thought that Marisol might just be a little bit depressed watching her dad in that situation.
Oh, wow.
Marisol didn't have a fever. She did not have a rash. She had that exhaustion with her body just feeling really heavy. So I kept insisting. After the third time, she finally gave in, got Marisol a test, and sure enough, Marisol had Valley fever. It's now been right 9 years later, and Marisol, her residual effects are gone. She doesn't have anything. That's when great. You are diagnosed, you will get over it, and it will go away. It's when you're misdiagnosed and it disseminates. It becomes a lifelong illness. So I've done a lot of things. One of them is kind of like a support group. You know, Valley fever is a very lonely disease. My husband, the Boricazole, has now caused skin cancer. So we don't even use light bulbs in my house. At dark, we do, but my husband covers up. He's never out without being covered up. And so it can become a lonely disease. If you are sick for years on end, my husband's now 42. He's been sick since the age of 33. And so it becomes lonely when the kids are at school and I'm doing something and he's alone. And not just him, but all our other survivors. And so there's a community garden right across the street from my Valley Fever headquarters in downtown Bakersfield. And we've adopted part of the garden. And we do meet up garden days. So not everybody can garden. You know, some people are missing limbs from Valley Fever. Some people are in wheelchairs. Some people just come out to sit and talk with the others. You know, there's nothing more comforting than hearing me too. You know, there's nothing more comforting than sitting down and sharing your story and seeing what's working for you. And so the garden gives us that opportunity to meet up and just to kind of, you know, bond with our fellow survivors. And then another thing that we do that's really exciting is our phone banking. Now, because I live in Bakersfield, I have a lot of people who show up here, but we also do virtual phone banking. And so people get on our Valley Fever page on Facebook, and I'll put the list of phone numbers there, and you can call from the comfort of your home, or like Melissa does. Last time she was in the hospital, she was phone banking from her emergency room. She was, you know, getting admitted, and it took him 2 days to find her a bed. And that Wednesday, she was phone banking, waiting for her bed upstairs in the emergency room. So we really need everybody. One thing that you can do is you can text the words Valley Fever to 54 54 54, and you can sign up for Valley Fever alerts. What that does is on days where it's going to be really windy, or you know, the extreme weather where Coxie's up in the air, we send out text alerts. Sometimes people get so busy throughout their day that they don't realize that the wind is just howling outside. So those Valley Fever alerts are just a reminder to people. Keep your kids and your pets, because our pets are susceptible also. Anything that breathes can get Valley Fever. The only thing that cannot get Valley Fever are birds. But every other living creature, we all can get Valley Fever.
Yeah, they even found Valley Fever in whales.
Absolutely. There's been a couple sea lions. Yeah, there's been a couple sea lions off the coast of Pismo that have died from valley fever. A couple years ago, a giant gorilla down in the LA Zoo lost their life to valley fever. Wow. There was a dolphin recently in Arizona at the new zoo they just opened up in Phoenix. Just passed away from valley fever. So, you know, even if they're, animals that we think of like water animals, they still come up to breathe and therefore they're still at risk. The governor's phone number is 916-445-2841. And so you can always call your governor and share your valley fever story or share what you know about it and tell him that we need more than a budget line. We need reporting guidelines and we need physician education.
That's excellent. Thank you so much. I want to thank both of you, Abner Vilches and Julie Solis, for being on the show. I think this was a great show. Lots of hot topics, lots of great facts. I mean, and it does bring the importance to valley fever and pushing it forward on the bill. Thank you so much, Julie. And please join Julie on her Facebook page, Valley Fever. That's the name of your Facebook page, correct, Julie?
Yes, it's a Facebook page. And I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, Valley Fever. So you can find me on all three.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And please, nurses and hypochondriacs, listeners, please get involved. Please call the governor and please make an impact. Thank you so much.
Thank you.